Ars Electronica 2009 Human Nature Podcast.
So again, I'm Sarus Farivar. I'm an Iranian-American journalist. I live in California. So we're going to have a quick roundtable discussion for about 20 minutes with Isaac and Shao and Hamid and Yevgeny out in space. And so I'd like to start with questions from the audience this time. There are people who have microphones. There's one. So if there are any questions, please just raise your hand. It's as simple as that. Anyone? No one? Really? All right, then I'll start. Yevgeny, this one's for you. And this was actually from David Sasaki. He wanted to know if you thought that activists would be more or less empowered if the internet did not exist.
I would rather stay away from making very broad generalizations. I definitely think that many NGOs and many activists have become empowered by the internet simply because it has allowed to do things which were never possible before for those working on a tight budget. So those who already had an agenda, those who were already committed to promoting a cause, I think for them, internet has been a big boon. Right? I mean, it has helped them tremendously. However, I think the traditional NGOs are not really the subject that we have to be tackling with. It's really the individual activists and people who would not normally fit the definition of an activist 10 or 15 years ago. Right? I mean, in the past, for you to count as an activist, you really had to go and spend at least a day or two standing with a placard near your mayor's office. You know, today, to count as an activist, all you have to do is to, you know, join a Facebook group or to, launch a cyber attack on the website that you don't like, right? And I think that we really have to think about the dilution of this definition simply because many people, I fear, do not graduate from this class of people who just use Facebook and think that they are activists into this more effective and this more professional cohort who actually live and breathe by activism, right? So I definitely think that the internet has stolen and has prevented some of those people into blossoming into, you know, fully-fledged activists. But the situation is much more complex, and we have to look at various actors from NGOs to individuals. So it's much more complex than just, you know, empowering or disempowering.
I'd like to turn to Shao. What's the relationship between this type of internet activism with respect to China, as far as you've seen?
We have always remembered China, given all the tremendous changes economically and socially, it still remains a highly authoritarian regime. In this case, in China's case, there's the official civil society capacity is still very weak. There's not many those civic organizations can hold the government very accountable. Therefore, the internet becomes the only alternative. The netizens who the internet users are using internet to communicate, to sort of mobilize, to the individually, each one can express themselves with a very relatively small a political risk. But aggregate them together and coordinate such expressions, becoming a considerable public opinion that becoming a increasingly more important political force in the Chinese society. There's an online saying, we don't have oppositional party, but we have an online party.
Anything you want to add?
I think in China, you know, there are very different internet culture, you know, in this country. I think maybe much more richer than some other places. Some very, very naive internet cultures, born from naive. But in China, it's very complex because of those daily, you know, confrontations between the authority and the internet users. So people found their places to create different kinds of activism actions. So they found a lot of place to well use their creativities. And of course, I think those creativities can be well used in some other places if they don't have to face the censorship problems, face the authority crackdowns. And maybe China economy can become better if people use their creativity to do some other things. But I'd love to see that, you know, these kind of activities can also be copied or used for other countries. For example, like 1 month ago, there is a very interesting and very illustrative, you know, action by internet users in China. Once there is an internet user, a blogger, whose name is Guo Baofeng, and his Twitter name is Amoist, he was arrested by the local policeman, and he managed to send the last tweet before he was his mobile phone was taken away. And then all the other people found his tweets and started to buzz the message all around the internet. And then we found that more and more people joined this campaign to try to save Guo Baofeng from being jailed for or being sentenced. And then people started moving from online and buzzing to the offline actions as well. They not only seek legal support for him, but also sent postcards to jail. So flood of postcards sending to Guo Baofeng's detention place. And the policeman found this kind of power. They felt that a lot. So eventually the guy was released by those tremendous, you know, flood of information they got. So they felt the power, and they have to take something, you know, to try to satisfy the internet users' opinions.
Anything more to add?
Well, maybe Cyrus, you know that in some there is always, you know, a difficulty to concerning the definitions. In some neighborhoods, probably in Iran, some of them, when you read newspaper, you are considered as an intellectual. But it doesn't mean that it's going to diminish intellectual status. I think in activism is the same thing. I mean, internet provided a real information pool, an opportunity for people who cannot even be involved with their real name to get involved with, you know, their pen name in the internet world. I don't think anything was stolen from somebody. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to give you guys another shot. Questions from the audience. Behind me. All right, right here, Mark. You don't have a mic.
Hi, I'm Mark. I'm actually here blogging for Smart Mobs with Howard Rheingold. And one of the things I explore personally is we talk about Facebook, we talk about the internet, but it's actually quite a small percentage of people. So when we talk about activism, we're talking about internet activism, but what is true activism, irregardless of internet?
Evgeny, do you want to tackle that one?
Sure. I think it is true that in many countries outside of, you know, North America and Western Europe, activism actually happens elsewhere. And I think, you know, Hamid may actually tell you more about, you know, Iran. But as far as I understand, what was happening on Iranian websites like Balatarin was much more significant than what was happening on Twitter, right? And the problem is that we still are mostly talking about Western tools and Western technology because they are much better understood by Western journalists and Western media. So, you know, we tend to talk about Twitter revolution because it's very easy for people reading about it in Austria or in, you know, Washington to understand what it means. If you start talking about Balatarin revolution or, you know, Tutbai revolution in Belarus, you know, it just wouldn't make any sense because it will take you five more paragraphs to explain it. So I do agree that we have to look beyond Facebook and we have to look beyond, you know, beyond Twitter. But the important thing to realize is that, you know, those platforms have enabled people outside of the countries where political events are happening, particularly with foreigners, to watch those events and participate in those events. And, you know, sure, it may be true that a lot of Americans and Europeans were trying to help Iranians via Twitter, but the Iranians themselves were using completely different tools. And it's important that that narrative doesn't get lost in the reporting. And of course, you know, the role that text messaging plays is also extremely important. And text messaging, by its very nature, is not a very public tool. It's not possible to go and look at the aggregated accounts of text messages, right? So those elements just often tend to be forgotten in the broader media narrative. And I think it's up to bloggers, you know, organizations like Global Voices, and just reporters like, you know, Cyrus, who's following it, to actually make sure that that account is still reflected in the media and not get lost.
Well, I think Iranians, you know, when they use different internet platforms like Facebook or Balotelli or whatever, there is not only to make a bridge with people outside country, it's a bridge within Iran. Imagine somebody is in Tehran, in the corner of city or in the province, he doesn't know what's going on. It's a 10 million population over there. It's create a kind of bridge between people inside country. It's very important to think. Knows of that. And I think platforms are important, but we shouldn't really focus on one or two and glorify them. I think they are coming and they are going, and some of them, you know, replace others. I think Iranian use a mixture of all. I mean, YouTube, Facebook, or Iranian ones like Balotelli and other websites and blogs.
Take those Twitter or Facebook, those tools, platforms, as a more metaphor rather than actually, that's the only place things happening. I agree that in many societies, when we talk about activism, we think about activists. Well, when you think about activists or activism, you also have to think about what's the real cause. People want to change something, and where those change, the real drive coming from. In a situation in China, for example, I was quoting a story of this earthquake school collapse. Every Chinese parent will care. No one wants their children living in a public school, that building, without guaranteed quality. But it's not everyone is an activist. Those ones who lost their children, who wants to express themselves or trying to hold the government accountable, are being severely suppressed. So in those situations, those individual activists are actually acting on behalf of representing a large population and actually deeply sort of resonated among the large population. Well, now we're coming in this kind of a situation in the context, and then we can think about tools. While we're sitting here talking to you and showing on the screen, this conversation simultaneously are being tweeting inside of China right now. I'm looking at the screen and I see a couple of Twitters in Hong Kong are tweeting it. And those Twitters has hundreds of followers inside of China. And who are those followers? Some of them are students, some of them are teachers, some of them are journalists, some of them bloggers. And this conversation, this message right here, actually is my daily experience engaging the conversation with them in the Chinese cyberspace. But now I'm communicating with you, but it will be communicated back to China again. And right this moment, these are the catalysts. Those individual efforts added together becoming a overcoming this what you call the threshold of the activism. There's more people active and there's more people will follow their action. And sometimes when the threshold is getting passed, you will see a collective action, which is that what I mean by cloud activism.
I want to extend, I echo Xiaoqiang and Amit's comments as well, Evgeny, because I want to extend it to an international context. I think those tools can dramatically help people to connect across borders. For example, like after Iran cases, I used Twitter to interview Amit for about 10 questions, right? Only 10 questions. But it has about over 1,000 reaction feedbacks from my Twitter followers at that day, and some of them help translate our Twinterview. I call it Twinterview because it's based on Twitter. So it's a kind of sentiment sharing across borders. So it's not only one country's issue. It's not just a problem, you know, one community facing. So it's a kind of international collaboration with this kind of new tools because of the time issue has been solved. For example, like before in China, if you even today the mainstream media was largely censored to report the what is happening in Iran. But internet tools, those social networking tools, can help people to identify the truthness of those information. Because I know Hamid very well for years, and people trust me, so they can trust my information source. They can understand that how important it is, and they can share the sentiment all the time.
Just to clarify what was being referred to earlier, this Iranian website, Bolotarin, is basically the Iranian equivalent of the website dig.com. It's a Persian language version. It does basically the same thing. I think we have time for one more question from the audience, if there's any questions that are out there. Back here, can we get him a mic? Great.
Hello, I'm Michael from Spain. I don't want to shift very far from the conversation, but Twitter and Facebook are in a United States servers, and somehow it's great to have this. I mean, definitely they empower the communication in between activists and all this. But at the same time, I just want to raise the question: and are we aware on how much the technology empowers us, but symmetrically makes us dependent? So definitely, Facebook can track political profiles very easily. So I think we're in a moment that activism can be very interesting in terms of networking and cloud intelligence and everything, but also the computers that run these softwares also are able to track very easily who are the most relevant persons. And so just to put the question on are we concerned on that, and are we focusing on that? Because it can be really dangerous in my point of view.
Can you repeat your question a little more tightly, please?
Yes, sorry. I'm just saying we're talking about activism in terms of how it empowers activists and how it changed many situations. But my question is, are we aware, the citizens and the users of Facebook and Twitter and all this technology, that they are not open source and peer-to-peer, but they are belonging to owners that relay in the lay in different law things?
Yeah, I understand the concern, you know, from a technical view as well, from personal privacy as well, data security view. This kind of concern came from a lot of technical and business, you know, settings, because we have to find the innovations from around the world to support those kind of requirements of activism. And we have to have a market selection from all around the world to find which kind of tool can help us in this situation, in different kind of situations. Of course, we need more open source solutions, and we need more clouds, you know, to help us to find flexible solutions and mesh up those solutions to try to solve different kinds of problems for different countries. For example, like in China, again, you cannot use Twitter normally with your normal internet connection. You have to use circumvention tools to bypass the censorship system. So it's dramatically affect people's interest to use Twitter. So they have to switch to some other solutions to use similar kinds of solutions to do the same thing, or trying to reach outside of China. So this kind of, I think it's a market selection from for this kind of choices. And you need consider a kinds of data security as well, privacy problems. But the rather, you, I think the necessary usage and the pragmatic, you know, function is more important to many countries. I mean, in this situation.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But thank you to everyone who participated online. Thank you for being here. Thank you to our speakers. Thank you to Yevgeny, who's gone now. Thank you to our translators again. Thank you very much. We're going to be taking a 15-minute break, so go ahead, grab a coffee, whatever, and please come back at 45 after the hour. Thank you.